Let's go set history on fire.
Whether you like history or not, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you've come to the right place. Daniele Bolelli is a university history professor, writer, and martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
Part two of a two-part series about the Persian expedition of the over 10,000 Greek mercenaries who participated in this Persian civil war between Cyrus and his brother Artaxerxes. If you haven't checked out part one, I strongly suggest you do that since we are about halfway through the story. And if you have, I will not waste your time further and I'll just get down to business right now. So the place where we left off was immediately after the Battle of Conaxa, when the Greek mercenaries thought they had won the battle, only to come back to camp and found that Cyrus, the Persian prince who had hired them, had been killed in the battle. His army had been disbanded. The Persian troops loyal to the king Artaxerxes had raided their camp, so the Greeks are now essentially alone, with no food, very little supplies, in enemy territory. So it really cannot get there much worse than where they are at right now. So by now, the Greeks are killing their own donkeys and beasts of burden for food, and they are using the wood from the arrows shot by the Persians. They are retrieving them all in order to use the wood and the shields of their enemies left on the battlefield for fuel to start fires. Finding themselves in these dire straits, the Greeks decide to send a message to Cyrus' uncle, who was the second in command in the army, a man by the name of Aryaeus. He had fled at the end of the battle, and the Greeks send him a message saying, "Look, if you come back, we'll fight the king again, we'll defeat him for you, and we'll give you the throne." Problem was that Aryaeus deeply appreciated the offer, but he replied, he sent some messengers back saying, "I cannot challenge the king because I will not get any support from Persian nobility. I'm not, according to the line of descent, I would not be the right guy. I would not have enough support. So even if we win, I would be unlikely to remain alive for long because Pallas' conspiracy would be probably created in order to get rid of me. So, you know, if you guys want to come with me, you're more than welcome to flee with me, but we're not challenging the king anymore." Finally, the Greeks and Aryaeus meet each other, they join forces, and they both go through this complicated ceremony of swearing oaths not to betray each other. And they do this by sacrificing, in short order, a bull, a boar, and a ram over a shield. And then the Greeks will dip a sword in blood, and the Persian will dip a spear in the blood of these three animals sacrificed. And I guess that's their way of saying, this is an official deal, we are doing this in front of the gods by making animal sacrifices, so this oath is sacred, it's not something that we can betray at any point. The fact that nowadays, anytime we make a promise, we no longer slaughter animals to make sure that we take the promise seriously, it may be a good reason for bulls, boars, rams, and other creatures to give thanks for the cultural changes in human history. Back then, as you can tell, no good promise was considered real unless some blood flowed. Now, having said all this, let's see where we're at. The Greeks, along with Aryaeus, they cannot really go back the way they came, since they barely made it when they were loaded with supplies, and now they have none. At this time when the Greeks are considering their options, King Artaxerxes sends some messengers to discuss terms, to trying to figure out what to do. And Clearchus, the de facto leader of the Greek army, replies, I quote from Xenophon here, "You can communicate this to him, that we shall have to have a battle first. We have nothing for breakfast, and no one shall dare to talk to the Greeks about terms unless he provides breakfast for them." So what they do now is they agree to a truce. The Persians decide, okay, you don't need to get into a battle because you didn't have breakfast. I understand you get cranky when you have no food, but maybe we can figure out another solution. So both sides agree to a truce in exchange for food. The Persians will provide them food so that we don't need to have another battle right away, and we can think about what are we going to do next. Tensions flare up again very quickly, though, when Artaxerxes sends another messenger asking the Greeks to lay down their weapons. One of them, by the name of Cleanor, give the standard answer that you hear so many times throughout history when one side asks the other to lay down their weapon. And the answer, I guess you may imagine what's coming up, is, "Come and get them." The Greeks basically tell them, we sooner die than surrender. There was a Greek working for the king by the name of Phalenus, who was sent among the king's envoys to the Greek army, and he made the following speech. I'm quoting from Xenophon here. "The king considers that, since he has killed Cyrus, the victory is his, who, in point of fact, is left to contest the empire with him. He thinks that you too are in his power, since he has got you in the middle of his territories, surrounded by impassable rivers, and can bring against you such masses of men that you could never kill them all, even if he gave you the chance of doing so." So the envoy is saying, look, you guys are screwed. There's just no, you're out of luck. You are at his mercy. Just accept his mercy. Let's see what kind of offer he can give you. Lay down your arms. And essentially, they are asking for an unconditional surrender. The Greeks don't quite see it that way. An Athenian by the name of Theopompus replies, and again I quote from Xenophon, "As you see, Phalenus, the only things of value which we have at present are our arms and our courage. So long as we keep our arms, we fancy that we can make good use of our courage. But if we surrender our arms, we shall lose our lives as well. So do not imagine that we are going to surrender to you our only valuables." To which Phalenus responded, well, apparently before even saying anything, he kind of smirked at this answer, and replied, "Quite like a philosopher, young man, and remarkably well expressed. All the same, let me inform you that you are crazy if you think that your courage can get the better of the king's power." So the two forces are at an impasse. The Greeks are not surrendering. The Persians are not quite ready to have another battle. So the king replies that, fine, keep your weapons, but if you move from the spot where you're at, the truce is over. So you need to stay right there for the time being until we figure out a solution. There are a few Greeks who ran away, but for the most part, the bulk of them remain together. In the meantime, they managed to get some supplies from nearby villages. And by then, 3 days later, Tissaphernes arrives. Tissaphernes, again, if you remember from part one, he was the satrap who had first informed the king of Cyrus' intention. He has been Cyrus' main rival and one of the king's key allies. Tissaphernes is sent to negotiate with the Greeks. And the way he presents himself, he acts as if he's going to be their friend, and that he's trying to gain clemency from the king for them. Tissaphernes say, look, we will let you go, and I offer to lead you back home. In the meantime, I will sell you some food, or if I don't provide a market, if I don't sell to you, I will allow you to forage along the way. But otherwise, as long as I'm selling you food, you guys cannot take food from the territory. The Greeks agree, not because they like to, but because they really don't have any other options, despite the fact that most of them don't have any money to pay Tissaferne for the food he's going to offer. So it's not exactly clear how they're going to be able to take him up on his offer. In the meantime, Tissaferne is enjoying his triumph. The king has given him the province that Cyrus had been controlling up until this point has been given to Tissaferne. And on top of it, one of the king's daughter has been promised to Tissaferne in marriage. While this is happening, Tissaferne is trying to figure out how to play the Greeks. He's smiling at them, he's saying everything is good, but in the meantime, he approaches Cyrus' uncle, the man we mentioned a few minutes ago, Arrhiaeus, and he offers him a pardon if Arrhiaeus is to betray the Greeks. So much for the oath they had sworn over ram, boar, and bull. The offer is, Arrhiaeus, you can either betray the Greeks, or the king can consider you his enemy, and we're gonna kill you. Arrhiaeus doesn't really want to betray the Greeks. He certainly doesn't want to break the oath he had sworn to them. But he has really little choice at this point, since the Greeks are eventually going to return home if everything works out, whereas Arrhiaeus has nowhere to go. He's going to stay in Persia, and being the enemy of the king would not lead to a long and healthy life. The Greeks are trying to be diplomatic here. They say they did not come here to fight the king. They were tricked by Cyrus, who had first told them they were hired to fight other people. But then once they were in Cyrus' service, they decided to be loyal because they are these loyal people who don't betray their word. And the Persians act as if they see the wisdom of this logic and say, sure, we'll let you go, we'll let you live on good terms, and Tissaferne will escort you out of our empire and back in the direction of Greece. Since his province is on the way to Greece, he'll take you along the way. Problem is, 20 days go by, and Tissaferne doesn't come back. So some of the Greeks are beginning to believe that the king is buying time, faking friendship, only in order to gather more of his army and wipe them out. So they want to attack first. Because the reality is, it would look bad for him to let the Greeks go home with tales of Persian weakness. You know, over 10,000 mercenaries who made their way into Persia fought against the king, and they get to make their way back home alive and well, that would not reflect very well on the power of the king. And the Greeks know it, so they don't quite buy this idea that the king is so willing to forgive. Clearchus, however, convinced them that the odds to fight are no good. And if the king wanted to attack them, he doesn't really need to gather that many more people, he could kill them now. So Clearchus is trying to reassure them, no, maybe this is a real deal, maybe they are truly offering us peace. We don't have to really worry about it. By this point, Tissaferne shows up again with his army, and the preparations to go home begin. Now clearly the two armies don't trust each other, and they are marching elbow to elbow for the next few days in this climate of heavy tension. Before we see what is going to happen between Tissaferne and the Greeks, let's go back for a minute to one of my favorite characters in this story. I'm referring to Parysatis, the mother of both Cyrus and King Artaxerxes. And as I mentioned in part one, Parysatis was very much partial to Cyrus. He was her favorite son. And so she's now in a bit of a weird spot, because on one end, she's going to mourn the death of her favorite son, but she can't appear to mourn him too much, or she would seem disloyal. Since ultimately Cyrus, even though he was her son, he was the enemy of the king, her other son. So she's in somewhat of a delicate position. And this position is made even more delicate by the fact that she wants revenge. Now, she can't obviously get revenge against her other son, but she wants revenge against anybody she can get who's not directly tied to the king. For example, she decides that the man who cut off Cyrus' head and right hand at the request of the king, he needs to go. How can she do that? You know, she can't really ask the king to eliminate a guy who ultimately had just obeyed his own orders. So what does she do? She challenged the king to a game of dice. And this is a game with very high stakes. Basically, the king, who apparently likes gambling a whole lot, has to agree to give in to whatever she asks if she were to win. I'm not exactly sure what happens if he was to win. We don't get to find out. But in any case, she does win this dice game. And she asks the king to release in her custody the man who had cut off Cyrus' limbs. The king has to agree to this, since that was part of the original deal. And once the man is given to her, she promptly has him flayed alive and crucified. So that's revenge number one. Statira, the king's wife, was horrified by this action, and she criticized Parysatis for her cruelty. In return, because again, Parysatis is not the kind of woman who let insults go unavenged, and she does not take well to criticism, she began encouraging her son, the king, to take as many lovers as possible, just in order to hurt Statera. But she's not quite done. This is not, you know, trying to get on the nerves of her daughter-in-law, flaying alive and crucifying the man who had chopped off the head of her son, is not the end of it all. There's more that she wants. The other guy that she wants is the man who had actually killed Cyrus in battle, a man by the name of Mithridates. And so she starts spinning a web to try to trap him. Again, she can't ask the king, hand him over to me or do anything like this, and by now I think the king is wise enough not to get into another dice game with her. So what happens is this. Mithridates had been rewarded with a whole bunch of gifts by the king. But the king had asked, he essentially wanted everyone to believe that he had killed Cyrus single-handedly, and Mithridates was not the guy who had done the killing. He wants to kind of spin this heroic tale of how the two brothers faced off in single combat and he was the one who did the killing, despite the fact that it's clearly not true. So the presents that he had given to Mithridates officially were only for bringing Cyrus' horse strapping to the king. Parysatis sees her opening in this and decides to invite Mithridates to a banquet that she's giving in honor of her son, the king. At the banquet, one of Parysatis' eunuch slaves begin to keep pouring alcohol into Mithridates' cup to get him drunk, and then he starts complimenting him for the great gifts he had received from the king. What they are doing here is they are slowly going to try to give him enough rope to hang himself with, hoping that he says something wrong that would result in the king's anger. And this is promptly absent. Mithridates starts boasting that he had provided such great services to the king that he deserved even more gifts. Well, that's strike number one. He's essentially saying that the king had been too stingy. That's not going to be a good idea. The eunuch, however, doesn't think that this is enough to fully trap him, so he eggs him on. He says, I quote, "I do not grudge them to you, Mithridates. But since the Grecians tells us that wine and truth go together, let me hear now, my friend." By the way, anytime people call me my friend, I'm always scared for my life. And this is one of those cases where he's like, my friend, when he's trying to set him up. Let me read the quote for you and I won't interrupt him with my stupid commentary about the word friend. In any case, let's go again. "I do not grudge them to you, Mithridates. But since the Grecians tells us that wine and truth go together, let me hear now, my friend, what glorious or mighty matter was it to find some trappings that had slipped off a horse and to bring them to the king?" In other words, he's saying, what great deeds have you done? I mean, Cyril, you just found Cyril's horse's trappings. It's not exactly a big deal. It's not a glorious. If anything, the king has been too generous in giving you all this stuff. Now, the eunuch knew perfectly well what had happened. He knew that Mithridates had killed Cyrus. But again, this is just giving him enough rope for him to hang himself with. He's setting up a verbal trap for him. So this mix of tickling the man's pride and alcohol makes Mithridates speak more freely than he would have been wise. Plutarch, in his biography of Artaxerxes, reports that Mithridates replied, "I declare to you explicitly that this end was the death of Cyrus, for I threw not my dart as Artaxerxes did, in vain and to no purpose, but only just missing his eye and hitting him right on the temple, and piercing him through, I brought him to the ground, and of that wound he died." Think about what Mithridates just did. That stupid, stupid man has implicitly accused the king of being a liar, since the king had claimed that he was the one who had killed Cyrus, and on top of it, he has also implicitly accused him of being an inferior warrior who missed the shot in vain, whereas Mithridates himself was this great warrior who got the deed done. So Parisatis' trap has sprung, and the man had fallen right into it. As Plutarch adds, the rest of the company, who saw the end and the hapless fate of Mithridates as if he were already completed, bowed their heads to the ground. You know, Mithridates is the only guy, as he's speaking this line, is the only guy at the banquet not to realize what just happened. Everybody else realize, okay, Mithridates, it's been nice knowing you, because after you saying this stuff, your days are counted. Mithridates' punishment consisted in the kind of horrible torture that makes you wonder about the mental state of the person who first came up with it. What the king ordered was that Mithridates was to be stripped naked, his body was to be placed between two wooden frames glued together, and only his head, arms, and legs would stick out. Well, this is weird, but what's so bad about this? Well, just wait. Next, after sticking him in this wooden frame, they force-fed him. If he didn't eat what they gave him, they would try to prick his eyes with a blade, threatening essentially to blind him. And not many human beings are able to say, sure, just go ahead and blind him rather than eat what they gave him. So he did eat everything they gave him. At that point, they smeared him with milk and honey to attract insects. And also, inevitably, the man urinated and defecated in the wooden crate in which his body was, so insects started entering in there as well. Flies arrived, and they laid eggs in his body going through his colon. You didn't think I was going to spare you the details, did you, right? When maggots hatched, they began to eat his flesh from the inside. Mithridates had 17 days to stay alive in these conditions before he died, to meditate on the truth that speaking too freely when you had too much wine in the presence of a king may not be the best course of action. So again, this is under the file, do not mess with the Queen Parisatis, because she was not the kind of lady you wanted to get on the bad side of. I'm willing to bet you're trying unsuccessfully to shake off this nasty image from your brain, because it's going to be etched in there for quite a while. What happens is that Tissaphernes again approached the Greeks, and what he does is he tells them to take anything they want. They are free to pillage a few villages along the way. Why would he do that? This is, you know, Persian Empire land. Well, these were villages that were under the protection of Cyrus' mom, Parisatis. So it was Tissaphernes' way to insult her. So you see these guys at the royal court, they are playing these power games against each other, and, you know, even though they may not be able to directly take out each other, they do whatever they can to get on each other's nerves. Tissaphernes and Clearchus, they meet again, and they give mutual speeches trying to put an end to the distrust that's reigning among their troops. Clearchus tells Tissaphernes, "You can trust us, because we have sworn oaths to the gods." And, I quote, "I do not see how one who is an enemy of the gods can run fast enough away, nor where he can flee to escape, nor what darkness could cover him, nor how he could find a position strong enough for a refuge." Which, this whole series of lines sound remarkably similar to a reggae song by Peter Tosh entitled Down Pressor Man. But in any case, aside for that, Clearchus also adds that it's really not in the Greek interest to fight against Tissaphernes, and he adds that if you want to hire them against the Egyptians, who are rebelling against the Persians at this time, they would be more than glad to do the job for them. Tissaphernes also gives speeches reassuring the Greeks of their friendship, and, you know, everything sounds great. Based on even just the way I'm saying it, and based on everything we've been saying so far, which is this tale of constant betrayals by everybody, you can pretty much imagine what's about to happen next. In the meantime, more intrigues are underway. Cyrus' uncle, Arrhiaeus, had started camping with Tissaphernes. So the Greeks understand that despite whatever oath they may have sworn earlier on, if by any chance a fight was to break out between Tissaphernes and the Greek army, Arrhiaeus would be on Tissaphernes' side. One of the Greek commanders, Menon, had become Arrhiaeus' lover. Again, as I mentioned earlier, homosexuality was quite common in this part of the world at this time. Or if not straight up homosexuality, definitely bisexuality. And Arrhiaeus had told Menon that if you are to get rid of Clearchus, you could become commander of all of the Greeks, and then we'll hire you to go against the Egyptian. So Menon figures, oh, if I only have Clearchus killed, then everything can work out. In the meantime, Clearchus had a meeting with Tissaphernes and suggested the possibility that if he wanted to become king, the Greeks would be on his side and they would be more than glad to go to war against the king on Tissaphernes' behalf, if he only wished it. Tissaphernes seemed pleased with the idea and he invited him to another meeting with all the senior Greek officers, saying, I like what you're saying. Let's talk this a little further. So out of the 8 main generals commanding the Greek army, 5 went to this meeting. And out of the 120 company commanders, 20 went to this meeting. And in addition, some 200 Greek soldiers went to this meeting. So Tissaphernes is treating them all to this big dinner. And what nobody realized, what neither Menon nor Clearchus realized, is that their personal rivalry for leadership had blinded them to the fact that Tissaphernes had been playing them both. All the generals go inside Tissaphernes' tent for this banquet, the captains wait outside, and the generals are captured. The captains and soldiers outside are massacred, and the Persian cavalry killed the survivors trying to escape. Only one Greek survives this treacherous betrayal. A man by the name of Nicarchus was among the soldiers staying outside of the tent, and despite being severely wounded in his stomach, he managed to run away and escape and reach the rest of the Greek army. To give you an idea of how bad this is, his wound is so bad that by the time he reaches the Greek army, he's literally holding his intestines in his hands, trying to keep them inside his body. And before dying, he tells the Greeks what has happened. So the Greek army, they arm themselves, they prepare for a big fight. Some 300 Persians, along with Arrhiaeus and Tissaphernes' brother, arrive in sight of the Greek camp, bringing a message from the king. The message is that Clearchus was killed for breaking the truce, and that the Greeks should now surrender their weapons, since the weapons used to be the property of Cyrus, who is a servant of the king and has now been defeated by the king, so you guys are in my hands, just give it up already. This speech does not go too well with the Greeks, who just found out that their generals and some of their main leaders have either been killed or captured, so a man by the name of Cleanor replies to this speech, saying, addressing their former ally, Cyrus' uncle, Arrhiaeus, and he says, Arrhiaeus, you utter villain, and you others who used to be Cyrus' friends, Do you feel no shame before the gods and before men? You took an oath that you would have the same friends and enemies as we had. And then you betrayed us with the godless and criminal Tissaphernes. You have killed the very people with whom you swore the oath. And now, after abandoning the rest of us, you come against us with our enemies. Now, on technical grounds, Tissaphernes could argue that he was justified in breaking the deal with the Greeks, since many of them, having no money, had kept foraging, even though Tissaphernes was offering goods for sale, and their deal was that as long as Tissaphernes was selling them goods, they should not be allowed to forage. Yes, he did allow them to pillage some villages belonging to Parysatis, but in no other occasion were they allowed. So technically he could argue that they were the one who broke the deal first and were oathbreakers. Not that this mean anything at this point, since both sides don't trust each other and they are ready to fight and both sides believe they are right. But just to present how Tissaphernes justified it to himself. What had happened is, despite what they say that they had already killed Clearchus, it wasn't really true. They captured Clearchus along with the other general, and they were brought back to the Persian capital, and eventually they were beheaded. Some of them right away, such as Clearchus. Parysatis had tried really hard to have Clearchus spared, but the king's wife, her daughter-in-law, Statera, had demanded Clearchus' death and got it. The other general were killed eventually. Menon was kept alive longer. He was prisoner / advisor. His position wasn't entirely clear. He was alive for over a year, but he was eventually killed as well. And Arrhiaeus, despite being Menon's lover, made no effort to save him. So if you thought that the situation for the Greeks was grim at the end of part one of this story, and that things would start picking up in part two, well, it looks like they just got worse. As Xenophon writes, with their generals arrested, and the captains and soldiers who had gone with them put to death, the Greeks were in an extremely awkward position. An extremely awkward position is a nice way of putting it, because they were really in serious trouble by now. They knew they were surrounded. They couldn't buy food from anyone. There was still well over 1,000 miles to go before reaching Greece. There was no guide to show them the way, major rivers standing in their way. They had no cavalry. Even the natives who had fought on Cyrus' side had switched sides by now, and they were with Tissaphernes. So the Greeks have a really long night after the generals are killed. Most of them don't eat that night, and heavy depression is reigning throughout the camp. Few are able to sleep, since all of them, their thoughts are consumed with the idea that they will probably never see home again, they will never see their parents, their spouses, their kids. In the midst of this horrible situation, Xenophon is going to emerge as a key character in the story. I'm going to quote from the Anabasis for you. Xenophon was no different from the rest, and now in their difficult position he was as miserable as anyone else and could not get to sleep. However, he got a little sleep in the end, and had a dream. He dreamed that there was a thunderstorm, and that a thunderbolt fell on his father's house, and that the whole house was on fire. He woke up immediately, feeling very frightened, and considered that in some respects the dream was a good one, because in the midst of his difficulties and dangers, he had dreamed of a great light from Zeus. So Xenophon wakes up from this dream, which, when you think about it, is to say the least an ambiguous dream, because on one end you have Xenophon's own father's house going up in flames, which may not sound like the best dream ever, but Xenophon decides to interpret it as a good omen, saying, well, it's a light from Zeus, so it's a good thing. So really this dream is very open to interpretation. It really depends how you take it. This reminds me, if I may go on a very short aside, it reminds me of a possibly apocryphal tale about the life of Japanese warlord Oda Nobunaga. The story goes that before a battle, he visited a shrine and tossed coins in the air, saying that if the heads came out, then it was a sign from the gods. And despite throwing a whole bunch of coins, which obviously when you throw like 10 or 20 coins in the air, clearly not all of them will be all heads or all tails. The odds are so crazy that that would happen. And yet, despite that, they all come up all heads. So everybody look at it and say, wow, how could this be? This clearly is a sign from the gods that we're going to win this battle, because there's no way that this could have happened by chance. So after they have the battle, when Nobunaga's forces triumph, Nobunaga's attendant, after the battle, told him, no one can change the hand of destiny. And Nobunaga laughed, pulled out the coins, and showed them that these coins have been shaped in a way that they show the heads on both sides. So it was a trick all along. He had tossed these coins in the air just to make his troops believe that the gods were on their side and they would be more motivated and their morale would be higher. But really, this was part of a trick. So in some way, unlike Nobunaga, Xenophon here is not being deceitful, but clearly there's not a single obvious message of his dream, and he decided to interpret it positively when he could have really gone the other way. So this dream is optimistically interpreted as a sign that Zeus would brighten his household, well, despite the fact that he set it on fire and burned it down, but that's a different story that Xenophon decided not to indulge in. So Xenophon wakes up, motivated to action, while all the other Greeks in the meantime are too bummed out to do anything. I'll quote again from the Anabasis by Xenophon. What am I lying here for? The night is passing, and at dawn the enemy will probably be here. If we fall into the king's hands, there's nothing to prevent us from seeing the most terrible things happening and from suffering all kinds of tortures. Yet, so far from anybody bothering to take any steps for our defense, we are lying here as though we had a chance of enjoying a quiet time. What city, then, do I expect will produce the general to take the right steps? Am I waiting until I become a little older? I shall never be any older at all if I hand myself over to the enemy today. So Xenophon wakes up from this dream and takes charge. He goes to visit some of the other captains, and while all the Greeks are confused and they whine and don't know what to do, Xenophon just comes through and tells them, look, if we're going to come through alive, we have to quit whining and we have to overcome our fears. We need to gain a sense of purpose. He delivers this speech first by mentioning what kind of fate awaits them. He says, I quote, if we relax and fall into the king's power, what sort of treatment can we expect from him? He's the man who cut off and fixed to a stake the head and hand of his own brother, his own mother's son, even when he was dead. So what sort of treatment can we expect, we who have no blood relation to take our side, and who marched against him with the intention of deposing him and making him a subject, and killing him if we could? Will he not go to all possible lengths in trying to inflict on us every conceivable misery, and so make all men afraid of ever marching against him again? No, it's surely clear that we must do everything in our power to avoid falling into his hands. Xenophon is trying to push the Greeks' morale. He's inciting them to stop sitting around complaining, get on their feet and get ready to fight. In another great quote from the Anabasis, he said, well then, in heaven's name, let us not wait for other people to come to us and call upon us to do great deeds. Let us instead be the first to summon the rest to the path of honor. Show yourselves to be the bravest of all the captains, with more of a right to leadership than those who are our leaders at present. So he's basically telling some of the captains, look, the men are scared, everybody's scared. They are looking at you for inspiration. You should be the one who need to find that courage, that fearlessness, to set an example that will raise the morale of the whole army. And in another brilliant speech. This is really Xenophon channeling his own inner football coach before the big game kind of speech. He says, "You're well aware that it's not numbers or strength that brings victory in war. It's whichever army goes into battle stronger in spirit. Their enemies generally cannot withstand them. I've noticed this point too, my friends, that in soldiering, the people whose one aim is to keep alive usually find a wretched and dishonorable death, while the people who, realizing that death is the common lot of all men, make it their endeavor to die with honor, somehow seem more often to reach old age and to have a happier life when they are alive." So Xenophon is using the Greeks' desperation as a motivating factor. He's saying, not entirely truthfully, that numbers and strengths have nothing to do with victory in war. Clearly they do. Obviously you cannot defeat insanely superior numbers, or if you do, it's a huge upset. It's certainly not the norm. But clearly emphasizing that point would not help the Greeks feel better about their situation. So what he's pushing for instead is this idea of, like, look, if you only stop being some scared cowards, if we show ourselves to be the brave men that we are, then we can still win this thing. We can still fight our way home. He makes actually a really interesting psychological point when he says that those who are only concerned with self-preservation, those who want to stay alive at all costs, often find themselves dead anyway, and on top of it meeting a dishonorable death. And that the opposite is true. The fact that sometime those who are willing to embrace death, because they know that eventually everybody's to die, so they are willing to just give up self-preservation and be ready to die with honor, in Xenophon's word, somehow seem more often to reach old age and to have a happier life. He's pointing to some strange paradox of human life, that sometimes the very people who are ready to lay down their life and die right now doing the right thing, in an odd kind of way, they may paradoxically survive longer than those who are trying to hide in self-preservation. This is, sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not, but it's still a good point in terms of, look, we're all gonna die sooner or later. Might as well meet death with bravery. Might as well meet death without fear and go out in an honorable way. If we manage to survive, that's a plus, but we can't even be concerned about it at a time when the odds are clearly stacked against us. So the rest of the army, they give him a standing ovation. Some of the other captains compliment him. They elect, following Xenophon's advice, they elect new officers. A man by the name of Chrysophus will become the new general of the army. Again, the name is Chrysophus. Also, they pick as main officers several different men, including Xenophon, who's raised to this position of leadership. So at dawn, the whole army gather together in an assembly. So they're having assembly after assembly to try to decide what to do. This is a very Greek thing to do. You know, in other parts, some one guy would be the new leader and lay down the law. The Greeks really sit down and talk things out among themselves. So some of the new generals denounce the duplicity of the king and of Arrhiaeus. Xenophon also gives yet another speech. He's wearing his best uniform, since he thought that more likely than not, there was a chance that he would die the very same day in battle, so he was ready to die putting forward his best appearance. And in this speech, he encouraged everyone else to take up arms and make the Persians pay for what they had done. As part of his speech, he keeps hitting the whatever point he can milk in order to raise the Greek morale. So he said, "The gods will be on our side, since we kept our oaths, whereas our enemy are oathbreakers." He also reminded the troops of previous Persian attempts to invade Greece, and how the Greeks always came up victorious. And he's telling them, look, you guys are the descendants of the people who destroyed the Persians in the past. You were born free. In Xenophon's words, "For you worship no man as a master, but only the gods. These were the men whose sons you are, and I shall certainly not say that you dishonor your fathers. Ready? Not many days ago, you were in battle order against the children of our old enemies. And though they were many times your number, you, with the help of the gods, defeated them. He continued the speech, saying, you guys were brave when we are fighting to win Cyrus a kingdom. How much braver are you going to be now when we're fighting for our own lives? And he also again tried to spin every fact in the Greek advantage, you know, like the fact that all of Cyrus' army had defected and had joined Tissaphernes by now, which clearly was not a good thing. He spun it, trying to make it seem like a good thing, saying it's better that they are on their side. How in the world would it be better for thousands of people to have joined your enemies? Well, he said they were a bunch of cowards, and it's better to see cowards among enemies than among your own lines. We have no supplies? Sure, we have no supplies, but we'll take what we need from their lands. I'm not worried about that. Again, quoting Xenophon's words. No, what I'm really afraid of is that if we once learn to live a life of ease and luxury, enjoying the company of these fine great women, the wives and daughters of the Medes and Persians, we might be like lotus eaters and forget about our road home. So here he's saying, I'm not even worried, victory will win. My main worry is that we'll be too successful, which again, obviously a joke in considering the conditions they're in. But Xenophon is really desperately trying to motivate the Greeks and make them feel that they have nothing to be afraid of, despite the fact that they clearly do. He say, let's go back to Greece and show them that Persia is ripe for the taking. What it tells the Greek army to do is to get rid of all the non-essential equipment. We are going to end up fighting, and, again in Xenophon's words, when people are defeated, as you know, all their property changes hands. And if we win, we must look upon our enemies as if they were carrying baggage for us. This is genius, I love this one. It's like the fact that they have nothing left of their own provisions and supplies, rather than seeing it as the obvious negative that it is, Xenophon saying, look, they are carrying our supplies for us, because we will beat them and we'll take it from them, so we don't even have to be encumbered carrying all these heavy weights. They'll carry them for us until we're ready to take it from them. So talk about positive thinking, right? He's spinning an hopeless situation in every possible way, trying to show the Greeks that they have no reason to be afraid. And he finishes his speech with the statement that anyone should make when making any proposal. He says, if anyone knows a better way of going about things than the one I have outlined, then let him have the courage to tell us of it, even if he's only a common soldier. Because, I mean, ultimately, Xenophon saying, look, this is my plan. But if somebody has a better plan, by all means, tell us, and we'll jump on it, you know. That's what we want. It's not about me or somebody else. It's not about ego. It's about figuring out what's the best solution for this problem. And as his last, in a secondary speech that he gives, he also gives this great line. Whoever wants to see his own people again must remember to be a brave soldier. That is the only way of doing it. So he's really, before the Greeks were loyal to their own commanders and their units, but as we saw in the conflicts between Menon and Clearchus, sometimes they could be in conflict with each other. It's only after Cunaxa, it's only after their generals are killed, that the Greeks truly become a united army. In the Greek camp, where also many prisoners of war were to be sold as slaves, women were taken as lovers and servants, many camp followers. And they, along with the Greek soldiers, set fire to the tents and the wagons. As Xenophon had said, we need to get rid of all the non-essential equipment. Some of the Persian cavalry at this moment attacked them with a volley of arrows. And the Greeks suffered heavily because their own archers could not shoot as far as the Persians. And the Persians were so skilled that they could even shoot backwards as they were riding away, killing them, killing the Greeks even as the Persians were retreating. Xenophon, the eternal optimist, said, this is good. He was good that he was a few of them, so now we learn from our weaknesses and we can fix it. It would have been a lot worse if many of them came, many more of us would have died. It's obvious that we need the slingers and the cavalry. People from the island of Rhodes, the Arrhodians, had a reputation for being good with the sling, which was a weapon that was, despite the fact of not sounding so fearsome, it was actually a very important weapon in the ancient world. And slingers can actually shoot further than the Persian slingers, since they use much smaller stones. So they create a body of about 200 slingers and 50 cavalrymen. They really didn't have many horses, the Greeks at this time. And after being harassed by the Persians, so they organized this body of slingers and horsemen to fight back against surprise attacks. So when the Persians came back with many more cavalrymen for another attack, the Greeks this time were ready, and the slingers were able to hit a lot of the Persian cavalrymen, and behind them the Greek cavalry and the infantry attacked. So they were able to capture 18 enemy cavalrymen and kill many of their infantry. They mutilated the corpses of the dead Persians to scare them into letting them know that the Greeks were demons out of hell who were going to do terrible things to them if they fell in their hands. So the Greeks are now marching away, trying to escape from Tissaphernes' army. And in the process of running away from Tissaphernes' armies, they reach the ruins of what once had been the very capital of the Assyrian Empire, Nineveh, which is located in modern-day Iraq and had been destroyed by the Medes at the end of the 7th century. By Xenophon's time, the once ultra-powerful Nineveh is little more than a bunch of deserted ruins, and none of the Greeks even know what they are looking at. They don't know that during its heyday it was the largest city in the world. Xenophon wrongly identified this as a Median town. In some way, this is a really powerful image about the transitional state of glory and success. Here you had a city that, not that many years prior to this, was one of the most glorious cities in the world, the center of this vast empire. And by the time Xenophon and the army goes through, it's just a bunch of forgotten ruins that nobody even remembers what they were all about. I remember discussing the Anabasis, the Persian expedition, this story that we're talking about with Dan Carlin. I remember talking about Xenophon's Anabasis with Dan Carlin, and Dan told me that this is his very favorite moment of the whole book. This image of the Greeks camping in the ruins of this ancient empire without really knowing what it is that they are looking at. You know, there's still some of the ruins of the Assyrian ziggurats all around, this battle for their life taking place. The Persians will keep attacking the Greek army all along. They'll have several small engagements. The Greeks are running so short on supplies that after every engagement they try to take all the arrows shot by the Persians in order to reuse them. So there are many, many small-scale conflicts between Tissaphernes' armies and the Greeks at this time. During a march, at one point, both the Persians and the Greeks are trying to reach the same summit to see who can control the area first, since obviously high ground is advantageous in military operation. So Xenophon led a group of Greeks to try to get there first. But one of his soldiers complained because Xenophon was on horseback, whereas the soldiers were on foot. So promptly Xenophon jumped off his horse and took the complaining soldier's shield, and he carried it for him. The other soldiers took this as a sign that something had to be done, so they beat up the guy who complained, and they convinced Xenophon after a while to go back on the horse, and they were able to reach the summit first. During the course of these operations, the Persians started burning some villages along the way in order to prevent the Greeks from pillaging them and living off them. Xenophon, the eternal optimist, again used this as a sign to encourage his men. He said, "You see, this means we're masters of the land. When they felt strong, They wanted to make sure nothing burned, and they wanted to protect their villages. But now they burn it as if it were our land. So it's funny how Xenophon is a brilliant psychologist in this. He uses every fact and try to find the positive side for the Greeks, the side that can make them feel strong and in control, and he milks it for all he can. So by this point, where there's a turning point in the story here. The Persians control the land in every direction except the north. In the north, there were mountains that were controlled by the Cardukians. By the way, I'm taking a total guess about how to pronounce it. Could be Carducci, Carducci, Cardukians. I'm not entirely sure. So let's assume I'm right and let's call them Cardukians. These guys were independent tribesmen, very warlike, and enemies of the king. So this was a land that was not under the control of the Persians. The king had tried to invade them, but very few of his army had ever made it back out of the mountains alive. These very misty, gloomy mountains were rather ominous, but the Greeks didn't really have many options. They couldn't travel west, since the plains were perfect for the Persian cavalry, and Tissaphernes had destroyed the villages there so that the Greeks couldn't travel in that direction. East would have been going away from home. South looked good because there was civilization, there were good roads, but it was packed with enemies. So the Greeks had to take the gamble and go into the mountains. Author Robin Waterfield, who has written a book about Xenophon's story, writes, "To the west, east, and south, then, lay the certainties of civilization, indicated by proper roads. But in those directions lay also the certainty of death. The Greeks chose uncertainty. They chose to enter the chasm of the mountains. They were already more or less lost, but they had to get more lost in order to stand a chance of finding themselves safe." It's a beautiful passage right there. It describes in great fashion the dilemma that the Greeks were facing. Tissaphernes was happy, because he figured that few of the Greeks, if any, would emerge alive from the mountains. They would probably all die there in fighting against the Cardukians, and he wouldn't even have to get his hands dirty or lose some of his men. So he liked it that they were going north. He thought he was sending them to their death. Since both the Greeks and the Cardukians were enemies of the king, the Greeks were hoping to find some common ground. But seeing thousands of armed men enter their land did not exactly make the Carduci feel very safe. As soon as the Greeks entered the mountains, the tribesmen abandoned their villages. So any hope of friendly contact was gone more or less immediately. There was really no way to communicate with them, so the Greeks ended up plundering their abandoned villages, which ensured the hostility. Whatever chance there was of friendly contact was gone. The Greeks try not to fully sack the villages to show goodwill and only take some food, but that was plenty enough to make the Cardukians mad. By the way, I've seen it written both Cardukians and Carduci, so if you hear me switch, that's why. So the Greeks try to call the Carduci to make a deal, but the tribesmen refuse to talk, and actually begin to attack in the Greek rear guard, killing some of them. The tribesmen harass them with slings, stones, and bows. The bows were powerful enough to pierce straight through the armor worn by the Greeks. So this is guerrilla warfare 101. You know, the Cardukians are not able to put up a standard army facing the Greeks, but they are extremely skilled in guerrilla warfare in their mountains. At night, the Greek army see the campfires of the tribesmen on distant peaks, and they hear them scream war songs echoing throughout the mountains. The Greek officers order their men to let go of all the prisoners of war they were planning to sell. Many of the prisoners begged not to be abandoned in the mountains, surrounded by hostile tribes. It was a near certainty that being left behind meant either being raped or killed or both. likely they were also being left to starve there. So being enslaved, as not particularly fun as that may sound, being enslaved by the Greeks was actually being lucky if you could stay with the Greek army, because if you were left behind, the odds were that life would be considerably worse for you. This is one of the many, many, many heartbreaking moments in the story. Imagine the terror of the people abandoned in these hostile lands. As Robin Waterfield wrote, there were no Geneva Conventions in the ancient world. There's no room for sentimentality or pity. So the army decided to let go many of the slaves because they were slowing them down. Some of the men refused to turn loose some of the women or boys they loved, so not all the camp followers were abandoned, but a decent number of them were. So in the days to come, the Carduchi kept up this guerrilla warfare and kept harassing the Greeks and killing them at every turn. The rear guard was under Xenophon and other captains. They faced the brunt of the Carduchian attacks. At one point, the Carduchians were blocking the one pass to go through the mountains. Xenophon, in the meantime, had captured a couple of prisoners in the fights of the previous days. So, I'm going to quote from the Anabasis. They, meaning the Greeks, they lost no time in having the prisoners brought before them, and they questioned them one at a time to see if they knew of any road other than the obvious one. However often and however fiercely they tried to intimidate the first man, he denied knowing of any other road. So, since he had no useful information for them, they cut his throat in front of the second man. The second man, apparently seeing his friend having his throat cut, decided that his memory suddenly awoken to the fact that, well, it turns out there is another road around it. Said he tells the Greek that the other guy had refused to give them any information about an alternate road ahead because he had a daughter married to someone in that direction. He did not have such family obligations, so he offered them to guide them. Think about how nasty this moment is. Here you have one guy who's been interrogated by the Greeks. They are asking him what's the way around it. He knows what the way around is. The problem is that the way brings this Greek army, this hostile Greek army, much too close to where his daughter is living. And he decided, I'm not gonna do that. So the Greeks cut his throat, but then the other guy will show them the way. So some of the Greeks send the soldiers down this way so that the next morning they can try to catch the Carduchians from the side while the rest of the army attack them from the front. This pincher move works to perfection and forces the Carduchians to abandon this pass and let the Greeks go. In 5 days in the mountains among the Carduchians, the Greeks had lost as many men as in 3 months among the Persians. This is a testament to how tough the tribesmen were fighting in this guerrilla warfare style. In the many of these little battles take place, eventually Xenophon, speaking through an interpreter that they had captured, suggested a truce to exchange the dead bodies of their fallen comrades. The Carduchi agreed only if the Greeks do not burn their homes. Both sides agree, but the Carduchi break the truce and attack them. So the Greeks end up occupying the houses in an abandoned village, and for the first time in a while they get to eat quite well. They do swap the debt with the Carduchi in exchange for a guide, and then their fighting resumes the next day. Despite suffering heavy losses, the Greeks managed to get to the other side of the mountains. On the other side of the mountain was Armenia, which was a Persian satrapy at this time. But things are not gonna get easier, not yet at least. They made it through the mountains, but by the time they get through, they see that the satrap of Armenia is holding the other side of the river with many soldiers. not his full army, since he had no time to summon them all, but more than enough to be a threat, and he's blocking their way. On top of it, the Greeks find that the river separating the two sides is too deep to cross. It was at least chest high, very fast flowing and freezing on top of it all. As they are getting ready to make camp for night, they see armed Cardukians coming down from the mountains. So the Greeks are caught. They are stuck between two hostile forces, both eager to kill them. What happens when the Greeks are in trouble? Xenophon goes to have a nap, and again he has a dream. Xenophon dreams that he's bound in chains, but that the chains fall off. So he wakes up, he goes to Cheirisophus, the leader of the Greek army, he tells him of his dream, and they both interpret it as a good thing. They believe that they will be successful crossing the river, and they offer a sacrifice to get the gods to smile on them. Two soldiers arrive, telling them they discover a spot upstream, where the far bank of the river was unsuitable for the Armenian cavalry, so it's an undefended spot, and it's a spot where the crossing is a little easier. Some of the Greeks, priests among them, cut the throats of many animals, pouring a whole bunch of the blood of the sacrificial animals into the river. They say that the omens from the gods are favorable, so the soldiers sing this battle song. Their women, the mistresses of the Greeks, join in singing this battle cry, and they go forward. They enter the river as if to cross, while Xenophon, along with the fastest man, they go upstream to ford there. So they are basically engaging in a feint designed to make the Armenians think that they would cross at a different point in order to then trap them. When they realize what's going on, the enemy army begins to flee. The first group of Greeks manage to gain the other shore. Xenophon's group is attacked by the Cardukians, who are coming down from the mountains. In the meantime, the Greek cavalry capture some of the carts belonging to the Armenian satrap, and while the Greek baggage train and camp followers are crossing the river, Xenophon and his men turn around to face the Cardukian attack. They get in battle formation with their back to the river. The Cardukians at the same time are chanting their battle songs as they come out, so both armies are exchanging these battle songs, and the Greeks attack. Seeing the Greek charge, the Cardukians decide to turn back and run away. But Xenophon had tricked them, because the second the Cardukians turn their back and run away, Xenophon has a trumpet sound indicating for all the Greeks to turn around yet again and cross the river really fast before the enemy can be back on their tail. So they basically faked it so that the Cardukians would retreat and they could cross the river safely. Good thing for the Greeks that Armenians and Cardukians hated each other, so this did not allow them to coordinate attacks on both sides of the river. Because of the continuous wars between the Armenians and the Carduci, no villages existed close to the river. But after several days of travel, the Greek army entered in western Armenia. There they met with a guy named Tiribazos, who was a sub-satrap of western Armenia, meaning there wasn't just the one that they had defeated already, there were other forces here. And Tiribazos tells them the Greeks can have free passage and take food as long as they don't destroy houses. As usual in these circumstances, it's a lie, and he was planning to attack them. They are running into heavy snow, so the Greeks have to use pig's lard smeared on themselves in order to stay warm. And some of the soldiers end up burning down some houses for fuel, which gives Tiribazos the justification to break the deal. The Greeks had captured a Persian who told them that Tiribazos was planning an attack at a narrow pass. So the Greeks attack first, and Tiribazos and his men run away so that the Greeks are able to capture Tiribazos' own tent. By this point, the Greek army is suffering heavily from heavy, cold winds that are sweeping through Armenia. quite a few soldiers and camp followers die because of the extreme cold and wind and lack of food, plus over 5 feet of snow were on the ground. Some go blind because of the snow, and some lose toes to frostbite. Many soldiers are too tired to go on. So Xenophon decides to attack some of the advancing Armenians in order to prevent them from catching the tired soldiers, and he was able to make the enemies flee. The Greek army managed to capture a village which was mostly built underground, maybe belonged to hobbits or something. The doors looked like wells, the homes were built inside the hills. The headman of this village is willing to cooperate, as long as the Greeks don't kill anyone. So the Greeks have a big party feasting on bread, lamb, pork, veal, chicken, wheat, barley, all the good stuff that at this time in the ancient world would have been prized commodities, and for that matter many other times in history. Cheirisophus was a bit mad with the headman of this village, because the headman was acting as their guide on the march, but after 3 days of marching they did not find any village, so Cheirisophus slapped him and just beat him up. During the night, not appreciating the treatment, during the night the headman ran away. And Xenophon was mad about this. He said, you know, Cheirisophus screwed up, he shouldn't have treated our headman in such a horrible way, and now we lost the only guide we had. I'll spare you some details, because the story can get repetitive at times. You know, the Greeks keep marching through the lands of a whole bunch of people, keep attacking them, they get attacked, there's always the struggle for food. But I want to stop for one incident that's particularly meaningful to me. In the Karga-Patsari Mountains, they attack a fortified town, which was stocked with supplies, and the Greeks by now are out of food. The defenders of this town start rolling boulders down the hill in order to prevent the Greek advance. Xenophon makes his men act as targets, kind of to show up so the defenders will use up all the rocks, and then his men are able to run off before the boulder hits them, and before you know it, the defenders are out of boulders to roll down the hill. So at this point, the Greeks are able to break into the fortress, and there's actually a competition going on between the Greeks to see who will be the first on the walls to get in. And here is what happens next. In Xenophon's words, this is what happens once the Greeks are able to break into this fortified town. Then, it was certainly a terrible sight. The women threw their children down from the rocks, and then threw themselves after them, and the men did the same. Xenophon even tells the story of a Greek officer trying to stop a man from jumping, not out of the kindness of his heart, but because the man was very well dressed and had jewels on, so he wanted to be able to rob him. But in the process of trying to stop him from diving to his death, both men fall to their deaths. Now, this whole moment to me is really the most intense moment of the entire story. When you're reading through Xenophon's account, it's natural to end up rooting for Xenophon and the Greeks. You want them to succeed. You want them to survive. You want them to, you know, they are the heroes of the story, aren't they? But then in a moment like this, you see things from the eyes of the people who are happily going about their daily lives, and suddenly they see 10,000 plus armed men ready to loot and rape, and suddenly the story appears in a very different light. The image of the people in this village who fight tooth and nail to keep the Greeks out in order to protect their homes and their children safe, only to see the Greeks break through. And so what do? They commit mass suicide, jumping from the walls. Think about it. Women who toss their children from the walls on sharp rocks so they would die immediately. Then the women dive, killing themselves, and then the men follow them. The whole village commit mass suicide rather than falling alive into the hands of the Greek. This is a tough image to swallow. I mean, this whole story is a war, is really a story of raw survival. In some way, the Greeks were doing what they had to do to survive. These people, the villagers, are doing what they had to do. In some way, this whole tale is something that, as Nietzsche would say, is beyond good and evil. It's a heavy moment. If this was a movie, I would picture a Dead Can Dance soundtrack playing as the noise of the battle fades into the background, the music takes over, and we see all the people jumping to their death from the walls. In case you are wondering what Dead Can Dance song is playing in the movie that's rolling through my head at this moment as I picture this story, it's called The Host of Seraphim, which is a haunting, powerful song. The tale continues in a bit repetitive fashion, with the Greek army marching through various tribal lands and some of the same scene repeating themselves. In one particular case among a tribal people known as the Chalybes, these guys had the curious habit of chopping off the heads of their enemies and then waving them as their friends, just to let them know they were dealing with tough people. So there's one of these encounters with the Greek army. Eventually, the Greeks are able to get out of the Chalybian lands and reach a town where the ruler of the town asks them to pillage the land of his enemies. And then if they do that for him, he'll give them a guide to take them to the sea. So he asks the Greeks to burn and destroy as much as possible of his own rivals. And the Greeks are only too happy to oblige, and so now they get a guide. After a long, long, long march, a huge cry goes up from the Greek army, making Xenophon and the rear guard thinking that they are under attack. As it turns out, they are not under attack. Something else is going on. From the top of these mountains that the Greeks are marching through, the troops finally caught sight of the sea in the distance, the very sea that they will eventually have to cross in order to get to Greece. But that's the sign that they almost made it. So the shout, the sea in Greek, thalassa, thalassa, breaks out throughout the entire army. Many of them have tears in their eyes because they cannot believe that they managed this amazing feat of crossing through most of the Persian Empire. To celebrate the moment, the soldiers build this monument, piling stones on top of each other. Now, if this was a movie, this would be the end of it. This would be kind of ending on this big climactic note. The story, however, continues. Much like in those movies, you look like you reach a climactic ending, and the image starts fading to black, and suddenly another scene kicks in, and you think, oh, I guess that wasn't the end. And they do it multiple times until eventually you're kind of tired of the whole process. This happens a little with the Anabasis. I mean, this moment is the keys. It's basically their sign that they made it. But the story continues a little bit more. I'll try to wrap up the rest of the story a little quicker, since it got really repetitive. So I'll skip some of the parts because it honestly gets rather tedious. I'll just try to give you the highlights. It's clear that the Greeks are getting closer and closer to home. Since they get to one of these new lands and one of their men who had been a slave in Athens says he recognizes language. This was probably where his parents were coming from, so he's able to act as an interpreter. So Xenophon uses him to ask the local population, known as the Macrones, why are they armed and ready to fight? And the Macrones give the obvious replies, like, you guys are invading our country, why do you think we're armed and ready to fight? Xenophon say, fair enough, I get it, but we really only want to get through, we don't want to invade your country. So they give each other pledges and exchange a spear each as a symbol of swearing an oath not to betray each other, and in this case, rare enough, they actually do. They stick to it, so the Macrones help the Greeks cross a river and get out of their country. By the time they get to the Colchian frontier, the local population is ready to fight. Xenophon encouraged the men, saying, look, these guys are one of the last obstacles that remain between us and home. So, in Xenophon's word, we should, if we could, eat them up alive. Talk about a quote, right? Right before going to battle, we should, if we could, eat them up alive. Nice, I dig it. That's a way to motivate his troops. So again, they sing their battle song, they charge. The Colchians decide that these wannabe Greek cannibals, they want no part of it, so they flee. The Greeks are able to take some villages. Here is there's a funny episode take place. They find this storage of honey that the Colchians had harvested, or some of it that was still growing there. And they decide, honey is great, why not have some? They eat it, and they start getting crazy sick. Turns out, in this particular country, the honey could be extremely toxic during some particularly part of the year. You would, if you eat it, it would give you dizziness, hallucinations, difficulty breathing. Some 350 years later, the descendants of the same people that Xenophon is dealing with will leave this honey as a trap for the Roman army of the general Pompey, who was invading this area, so that they would eat it and in turn get sick, and the same story would repeat itself. Now, despite this incident with the honey, the Greeks are in a celebratory mood. So at one point they decide to organize some athletic games, which was a really a classic Greek cultural characteristic. Every so often they would have this athletic competition with horse races, boxing, pancration, which was kind of the equivalent of modern-day mixed martial arts, wrestling. And some of the wrestlers in particular said, look, we want to have the athletic games as much as the next guy, but the ground here is too hard. It's really not good for wrestlers. If you get thrown, it's really hard ground. And the Spartan organizer of these games said, well, all the wars for the man who gets thrown. That's a Spartan reply right there. It's like, the ground is hard, well, just don't get thrown. That's how you can solve the problem. So they have these games where they run races, wrestling, boxing, pancration, horse races, the whole thing. As they now reach the sea, Cheirisophus says that he'll go to visit the commander of the Spartan navy in the area to try to secure safe passage for all of the men. In the meantime, the Greeks move a little down the coast and sell all of their prisoners of war and the goods that they had taken from Tiribazus. Xenophon make bank selling a lot of what he had acquired. He'll eventually use some of this money to build a temple to Artemis back home later. Eventually, they begin having to do expeditions further and further away to supply themselves. And in one of them, they get into a conflict with some of the most warlike tribes of the Black Sea. They engage in this heavy siege of their capital, and they have a brutally tough battle. They burn the city to the ground, yet they don't fully defeat the enemy. They get the supplies, though. That's good enough. By this point, they have only about 8,600 men. The others have either deserted or they are dead. I'll spare you a little of the details, but basically what we have now is a series of engagements where the Greeks make an alliance with some people to fight their enemies, and they do that together, they conquer these lands, they get the supplies, then they do that again a little bit down the road. This happens time and time again. Xenophon has some great lines here and there. One of the quotes about, in commenting about the story of the Greeks being able to conquer some of their enemies' lands is, one of the results of power is the ability to take things that belong to the weak. Talk about a Machiavellian quote right there, or one of the results of power is the ability to take things that belong to the weak. This, in a nutshell, is the story of what's happening, as the Greeks are pillaging everywhere along the way. In some cases, the pillage is weird how there can be ethical pillaging and unethical pillaging in the eyes of the Greeks. The ethical pillaging is pillaging the lands of people who are enemies. But in one case, a company commander by the name of Clearetos attacks a friendly village, and he in turn is killed by some of the villagers. Some of his men then killed the messengers from a town who wanted to tell the rest of the army what had happened. So here we have four offenses: attacking a friendly village, keeping it secret and in the process denying fellow Greeks a proper burial, killing the messengers who are trying to warn the rest of the Greek army of what had happened, and in the whole process betraying the whole army. These actions make them many enemies in the area. Now that the Greeks are no longer in the same danger of death and the odds look stacked against them, the army that had managed this amazing feat of staying united during all this time is beginning to break down. Xenophon is a bit disgusted. He proposes that the army needs purified, which is a ceremony that normally takes place after a mutiny. And they really need to get their act together if they want to get back to Greece, because they are losing their focus. So as I mentioned earlier, the high point of the story is when they saw the sea. After that, the story gets a bit nasty as the Greeks get greedy and they start pillaging left and right and they lose their common purpose and they're often at odds, different branches of the army are at odds with each other. Xenophon, in the meantime, has problems of his own. There are various political squabbles that break out in the army. In one case, a guy accused Xenophon of having hit him. Xenophon says that it's true, but that's because this guy was about to bury alive a fellow wounded Greek because he didn't want to carry him anymore. So the assembly clearly supports Xenophon over this. There was a political dimension to the conflict. Some people were accusing Xenophon of wanting to set up a colony on the Black Sea, whereas many of them wanted to return home and live off the wealth they had made during the trip. So Xenophon backs down from these projects of colonization along the Black Sea for the sake of unity. The army, in the meantime, is splitting into factions. There's a group of 4,000 Arcadians who are planning to raid in Thrace. There's another faction with 2,000 people, and Xenophon controls about 2,000 people. The 4,000 Arcadians are plundering in Thrace, but they find out that the Thracians were quite strong, and they are beginning to beat them badly. So Xenophon finds out that this one section of the army is losing many men, so he goes to the rescue and manages to save them. The three branches are now reunited again. In the meantime, Cheirisophus, the main leader of the army, dies during a fever. A guy by the name of Neon, not Neo, the guy from the Matrix, a different guy, Neon, takes his place. Neon was an enemy of Xenophon. They didn't really get along very much. For a few days, the omens are against doing any kind of expeditions for supplies. Problem is that the Greeks are starving, and every day they sacrifice, and they find out that the priests are saying, no, don't go out today, it will be bad. Neon gets impatient, ignores the omens, and goes out. But the Thracians manage to kill a whole lot of them. 2,000 Greek soldiers go out, but 500 of them are killed by enemy cavalrymen. So Xenophon said that the losses were caused by greed, disunity, and not listening to the omens. Yet again, Xenophon goes to rescue this force that had gone out. He tells his own soldiers that it's okay to have a ravine behind them, since the only hope is to win, and retreat is not an option. So, same story. Sing their battle song, go forward, big Greek victory. In the meantime, problems are brewing with fellow Greeks. In this case, the Spartans, who controlled that city, will be one of the greatest cities in this part of the world, Byzantium, later Constantinople, later Istanbul. The story here gets complicated, and again, I don't want to lose you guys in all the details, because moral of the story, the diplomatic contacts between the Spartan forces in Byzantium and the remainder of the 10,000s are not exactly smooth. There are several moments where the Spartans view the 10,000s by now as a rowdy mob, and they don't trust them, and they refuse to help them. In turn, the Greek army get mad and start pillaging some of the Spartan land. Again, without getting into all the complicated political machinations, the meeting between this Greek army and the Spartans is not a happy one among friends. There will be quite a few tense moments. But in the meantime, a Thracian ruler by the name of Seuthes offers to hire the Greeks to help him win a kingdom for himself. And the Greek army agrees. So during the winter of 400/399 before Common Era, the remainder of the 10,000 will serve in this campaign in Thrace during a civil war among different Thracian factions. Ironic, after all this time, these mercenaries were originally hired for a Persian civil war, are still fighting in a civil war, in this case among the Thracians. The story continues with this great party between some of the Thracians and the Greeks. Xenophon reports getting royally drunk while drinking wine from the horns of some bulls, which looks manly enough. And then we see lots of fighting on behalf of Seuthes against some of his Thracian rivals. Again, I'll spare you the details. There's an interesting story about one of Xenophon's men, a guy by the name of Episthenes, begs Xenophon to intercede with the Thracian ruler Seuthes to grant him a particularly beautiful boy that he had fallen for. Xenophon explains to Seuthes, "Look, this is what Episthenes is like, that's what he likes. Would you mind helping him out?" So Seuthes asks Episthenes if he were willing to die in place of the boy, and the Greek man replies yes. Then he asks the boy, "I'm gonna kill one of you guys. You tell me which one. I'm gonna kill you, because since this boy was one of the Seuthes' enemies that he had captured, or I'm going to kill Episthenes, this Greek who claims that he's in love with you. Which one should I kill?" And the boy says, "Don't kill either one of us." Episthenes hugged him, and Seuthes laughed, thought he had played a great joke, and he decided to release the boy in the custody of Episthenes. The Greeks by now have won a kingdom for Seuthes. Problem is that Seuthes' Greek administrator, a guy by the name of Heraclides, was giving the Greek soldiers a lot less money than they had been promised. So the soldiers are quite mad. And Seuthes, in turn, is no longer friendly toward Xenophon and his Greek men. So when Heraclides tried to undermine Xenophon, since Xenophon had questioned him on his ability to do what was best for Seuthes and basically accused him of corruption, and Heraclides promised 2 months of pay to the soldier if they only pick different leaders. This was an obvious maneuver to try to undermine Xenophon's power. And yet the soldiers, in a really dramatic moment, because again, keep in mind, these guys are mercenaries. Everything they do for money. And here you have this guy saying, "I'll give you 2 months of pay if you get rid of Xenophon and pick a different leader." And the soldiers reply they wouldn't pick a different one even with 5 months of pay, because Xenophon had played such a central role into getting them alive out of Persia. So at this point, the Spartans show up on the scene, saying they want to start a war against Tissaphernes, and they would like to hire the ones who are still alive among the 10,000. Seuthes sees a great opportunity to get rid of the Greeks without paying them. So during a banquet with the Spartans, the Spartans ask, "What about Xenophon?" Seuthes tells them, "Well, he's not bad, but he's too friendly with common soldiers." And the assembly the next day with the Spartans, some soldiers criticize Xenophon, and they want to go with the Spartans right away. They accuse Xenophon of having stashed away money. And he defended himself, saying, "What are you talking about? Me stashing away money? It's Seuthes who didn't pay us." In the words of Xenophon, "Are you not ashamed of yourself for being so stupidly taken in? I should certainly be ashamed if I had been taken in by someone who was an enemy. But in the case of a friend, I think it is more shameful to practice deception than to suffer from it." So he gives this long, moving account of his action in behalf of the soldiers during the past year plus time. And by the end of the speech, the Spartan leader says that he doesn't see any reason why the soldiers should be upset with Xenophon. Many of them begin to realize that Heraclides is the one who has been pocketing all the money, cheating both the Greeks and Seuthes along the way. Seuthes offers Xenophon to stay with him along with 1,000 soldiers. Xenophon performs a sacrifice, but he says that Zeus has spoken and told him that it's better for him to go with the Spartans. So he has a last talk with Seuthes. Seutes understands that Heraclides was the one to blame. He's the one who has been cheating them both. So he pays up the money that he owed the soldiers. Xenophon promptly pays his soldiers. And they leave on good terms. By 399, the Spartans and the Persians will be at war. Tissaphernes had imposed heavy tributes on the Greek cities in Asia Minor as punishment for siding with Cyrus. And the cities in turn had asked the Spartans for help. So for a little while, Xenophon and his men are employed by the Spartans against Tissaphernes. In one of the last actions in this story, Xenophon and his men are able to capture a Persian noble and all of his flocks, all of his wealth, so Xenophon made bank one more time before abandoning the army. So in this one last trade, he's successful. But by now Xenophon has had enough, so he hands the army over to the Spartans, who go to war with Tissaphernes, while he himself returns to Greece. Eventually, later in his life, Xenophon will fight with the Spartans against his own people, the Athenians, in 394. He retired later from military life and settled close to Sparta. Not surprisingly, he was exiled by Athens as a result of this, but the exile was repealed in the 360s. So Xenophon's own sons became citizens and served in the Athenian cavalry. One of his sons died fighting in the Battle of Mantinea in 362. And, so that's a little bit about Xenophon's life afterwards. But that's not really what I want to end with. There's one story that I want to touch on before discussing the legacy of this old tale. And who did I mention is my favorite character in the story? Where do you think I'm going to go back to? Yeah, you got it right. It's Parysatis, the mother of both Cyrus and Artaxerxes. Xenophon's story is over, but our story still has time for one last big moment. The Spartans are beating Tissaphernes, and this gives the queen mother Parysatis a chance for her revenge. You think I would forget about her? Not quite. She's after all one of the greatest characters in this tale. Let's see what happened with her. She hated Tissaphernes, since she mainly blamed him for the death of Cyrus, because she believed that he was the one who pit the brothers against each other in order to gain more provinces at Cyrus' expense. So by the time when, in 396, the Spartan king Agesilaus had beat Tissaphernes on several occasions, this led to Tissaphernes' loss of grace in the eyes of the king. The king begins to think that it's his fault to have caused the war with Sparta because of his harsh treatments of the Greek in Asia Minor. So the rumors in the Persian court are that Tissaphernes wasn't just failing at gaining good results, but he was actually planning rebellion. Nobody knows whether it's true or not, but this is enough to make the king suspicious. So Parysatis is able to convince the king to have Tissaphernes executed. The king's grand vizier visited Tissaphernes with two letters. The first letter confirmed Tissaphernes' supreme rule in Asia Minor, so it sounds like the king is on his side and he still likes him. But the other letter goes to Cyrus' uncle, Arrhiaeus, with the order to kill Tissaphernes. So Arrhiaeus invites Tissaphernes for a conference, and when afterwards Tissaphernes goes to take a bath, Arrhiaeus' men capture him and later cut off his head, which is going to be sent to court. This is Parysatis' ultimate triumph. Eventually, Persia and Sparta make peace, but not before Tissaphernes loses his head. Her revenge was now complete, since 4 years earlier, she had already gotten rid of her main rival. In the year 400, she had invited Statera, which, as you may remember, Statera was both Artaxerxes' wife, so the wife of the king, it's her daughter-in-law, and on top of it, she was Tissaphernes' sister. And she had been Parisati's rival all this time at court. On this one day, she invited Statera and Artaxerxes to dinner. You know, very innocent, inviting her own son and daughter-in-law to have a nice dinner together. But here is what she did. Statera didn't trust her, obviously. She knew that Parisatis hated her. So in an effort to lower Statera's guard, Parisatis took a small bird that they were going to eat for dinner, and she cut it in two, giving one half to Statera and keeping the other half for herself. So clearly, even Statera, who probably expects her mother-in-law to be trying all sorts of tricks to get rid of her, she wouldn't think this bird is poisoned, right? They are sharing the same bird, they are eating the same food. But this is why Parisatis is who she is. The knife that she had used to cut this bird had been poisoned on only one side, so as to smear the poison on one half of the bird while leaving the other one completely safe. And so, within a few minutes, after Statera ate it, she started getting really sick, got poisoned, and died. Everybody knew what happened. Everybody knew that Parisatis was guilty, but there was no evidence to confirm it. You know, how could they accuse her of poisoning Statera when they ate the same food? So the king knew what was going on, but couldn't have his mother executed over this. So he banished her for a year or two, but eventually recalled her to court. So this is Parisatis' ultimate triumph. She had gotten rid of the man who had cut off Cyrus' head. She had gotten rid of the man in brutal fashion of the man who had killed Cyrus. She got rid of her daughter-in-law that she hated all along. And she had finally managed to get rid of Tissaphernes as well. Aside from this particularly juicy poisoning story, let's look for a second at the legacy of this old tale. Now, on one end, Xenophon's story is a heroic tale of overcoming impossible odds, but is also quite pessimistic about human nature. You know, the disagreements among the Greeks that pop up as soon as they don't have a common enemy are a constant theme in this story. But regardless of its philosophical leanings, this story offers major practical impact on world history. What's so important about a few thousand Greeks managing to get out of Persia alive? Well, it's really important because the experience of the 10,000 convinced the rest of the Greeks that Persia was weak. Philip II of Macedon, inspired by this story, began to think that Persia was ripe for the taking. Polybius himself, Polybius is a very famous ancient historian, argued that the cause of Alexander the Great invasion of Asia was, I quote, the retreat of the Greeks under Xenophon from the inland satrapies, during the course of which no barbarian dared to stay and face them, even though they crossed all of Asia, a hostile land. So in other words, what these guys are saying is, look, the fact that these few thousand Greeks were able to escape unarmed, crossing the entire breadth of the Persian Empire, tells you something about the relative strength of the Greeks versus the Persians. The Persians have built this great empire, but they clearly don't have the muscle, they don't have what it takes to stand up against a serious Greek army. And if just 10,000 Greeks can do this, what if a bigger army, more than 10,000 people, was to try to invade Persia? This plants the seeds on this idea that will eventually bloom in Alexander the Great's mind. Arrian, in his work about Alexander's life, twice compared Xenophon to Alexander. And Alexander himself mentioned the 10,000 in a speech that he gave to his troops before the Battle of Issus. In the words of Eunapius of Sardi, a historian of the 4th century Common Era, he said, Alexander the Great would have never become great without Xenophon.
Bye.